our backyard. For the last 3 or 4 years, that has not happened. That tradition ended because we renovated our backyard, put in a parking pad, basketball pad instead. But for 9 years, 9 winters, I made a skating rink in the backyard, and our boys from very young on learned to skate there. And over the years, it got bigger and bigger and bigger until it finally, the last several years, covered virtually our entire backyard. It's not a huge backyard, but it was a fairly large rink considering the size of our yard, about 30 feet or so wide, about 45 feet long. Now, if you've ever been to our backyard, you may recall that our yard slopes fairly significantly. So to have a rink that went 45 feet off the back of our house meant having ice about 3 feet thick at the far end in order to have a level ice rink. As you could imagine, that takes a considerable amount of snow and water. And so I was the guy every winter, as winter came, that was excited when it was cold. Minus 25 was ideal. I was excited when there was lots of snow. And when there wasn't much, it was frustrating. Now, it's amazing how quickly that all went away when I stopped making the rink. But anyways, I digress. I remember one of those particular winters getting the rink ready. I'd set up the boards and you're waiting for snow, and a little bit of snow came, but it came slowly that winter, as I recall. There wasn't a lot, and really I had to build it up a lot, so I needed snow. So I would shovel everything from the yard and throw it in over the boards, and then I'd go to the front yard and take a garbage can and shovel it in and drag it to the back and pour it in. A garbage can of snow really doesn't make a big dent when you need that much. And I would slowly, painstakingly work at this. But one day, my neighbor drove home from work, Scott. And he didn't drive home in his own vehicle. He came home with a work vehicle, a giant front-end loader. It was awesome. He pulled in the lane and he said, "Hey, Dennis, do you need some snow?" I'm like, "Yes." And I think he did a couple laps around the block, and with this bucket that holds I don't know how much snow, a lot more than a garbage can, he came and just dumped it in to my boards, and I had more snow than I could deal with. It was an amazing help at getting that rink up and skatable that winter. That story, that illustration, begins to move our thinking and begins to move our hearts in the direction that this story leads us this morning. We're looking at a story in Luke where at the end of it, the people will say, "God has come to help us." Now, no illustration in the world will come even close to showing the help that God has brought, the help that God brings into our lives. But this begins to move our thinking to this idea of just needing help and then that help coming. And it's an amazing moment. It's an amazing moment of celebrating and worshiping. In this story, that thinking begins to take form. It shapes our understanding. Jesus will perform a truly remarkable miracle, a truly remarkable act, and the people will respond with those words, "God has come to help his people." Jesus' ministry at this point in Luke's gospel is well underway. He has been baptized. He has faced his temptation. He has begun to travel around, teaching in synagogues, healing those who are sick, casting demons out of those who are possessed. By this point in time, Jesus is already beginning to experience opposition and pressure, opposition and rejection. And so Jesus has already called from among those following him. He's called 12 men and appointed them to be uniquely his followers. He's designated them his apostles. And in so doing, he's really reconstituted the people of God, the nation of Israel, new Israel, the people of God, to be who he called them to be, those who would represent God. And so Israel is no longer centered around Jerusalem and the temple, but now centered around him. Following his appointment of the 12, Jesus preached a sermon on the plain where he defines those who are his people, his kingdom people, women and men who are poor. That is, not necessarily materially poor, but poor spiritually. They understand their spiritual bankruptcy before God. Those who are hungry, not necessarily physically hungry, but those who hunger for things to be the way they're supposed to be. Those who weep, not necessarily those who weep for the regular things in life that cause us to weep, but those who weep over their sin and the sin of the world, the brokenness of this world, those who are hated because of their allegiance to Jesus. And then Jesus begins to explain what kingdom life looks like, that those who are his kingdom people are those who are learning to love their enemies like he has loved his enemies, that they are those who reject judgmentalism and show grace, that they are those who seek to follow Jesus in lives of obedience. Upon the conclusion of that sermon, Luke shares two stories. The story we looked at last week and the story we look at this week. Now, these are stories that a number of weeks ago while I was away, Brad Wright spoke from. He used them as a jumping off point to explore the theme of faith. And what we've done last week and this week is circle back and dig deeper into each story in particular. Last week we did that with a story in the beginning of chapter 7. And today we come to the story in chapter 7, verse 11 to 17. If you were here last Sunday, you'll recall that it's centered on Jesus' encounter with a Gentile, an army captain, a centurion, who demonstrated faith that amazed Jesus. And Jesus in that story, without showing up at his house, just with the word, heals that man's servant. This morning, Luke tells us a second story about Jesus doing something even more remarkable than that. But before we turn and read the story, I want to explain or remind you of something when it comes to Jesus' miracles. I've said before, and I want to remind you this morning, that Jesus' miracles, when Jesus does his mighty deeds, these amazing things, signs, wonders, whatever they are called, Jesus is not merely performing party tricks to gather a crowd. Jesus is not showing off, hey, look what I can do. Jesus' miracles themselves are part of the revelation of who he is. Jesus' miracles, his mighty deeds, teach us, they show us, they speak to who he is, what he's about, what he is like. And it is so important for us to understand that as we come to this text this morning, to grasp that all the way through the gospel, but to understand that this morning. Last week, Jesus healed a man from a distance, a man who was close to death. This morning in the story we're going to look at, Jesus resurrects a man, raises a man back to life, a man who was already dead. So with that in mind, Jesus' miracles themselves reveal something about who he is, what he's like, what he's about. I want to invite you to follow along as I read our text this morning, Luke 7, verse 11 to 17. Soon afterward, Jesus went to a town called Nain, and his disciples and a large crowd went along with him. As he approached the town gate, a dead person was being carried out, the only son of his mother, and she was a widow. And a large crowd from the town was with her. When the Lord saw her, his heart went out to her, and he said, "Don't cry." Then he went up and touched the bier they were carrying him on, and the bearers stood still. He said, "Young man, I say to you, get up." The dead man sat up and began to talk, and Jesus gave him back to his mother. They were all filled with awe and praised God. "A great prophet has appeared among us," they said. "God has come to help his people." This news about Jesus spread throughout Judea and the surrounding country. If we approach this story, if we come to it simply on its own terms as a standalone story, it would stand as a remarkable story, to be sure. Jesus encounters a funeral procession. He stops it. He touches the bier that the dead man's body is being carried on, and he speaks to that corpse. He says, "Young man, get up." And this dead man sits up. Amazing. Remarkable. It would be a remarkable story, just on its own. But as we read this story, we have that sense of amazement. But what I want to remind you of, what I want us to understand, is that as we encounter, as we look at this miracle story, the story of Jesus doing this remarkable, amazing thing, there is more going on than simply the amazing deeds, the amazing events in the story. Because this miracle, like all of Jesus' miracles, is revelatory. It speaks to who he is. It speaks to what he is like. It speaks to what he is all about. So more is being revealed here. We need to ask those questions. We need to think deeply. And so as we walk through this story, This morning, there are four amazing things, four important things that we learn, that we discover, that we are reminded of about Jesus and about his ministry. And so in the time we have left together this morning, I want to identify and unpack each of those four things. Let me set the stage for our walk through this story. I want you to look with me again at verses 11 and 12. Because they really establish an important context for us as we walk through this. We read there again, "Soon afterward, Jesus went to a town called Nain, and his disciples and a large crowd went along with him. As he approached the town gate, a dead person was being carried out, the only son of his mother, and she was a widow, and a large crowd from the town was with her." Soon afterward. Soon after the events that we read about last Sunday, soon after Jesus' encounter with the men that the centurion had sent to him, soon after Jesus had healed that man who was at the point of death, soon afterward, Jesus and his disciples, and evidently a large crowd from Capernaum, perhaps they picked up some stragglers along the way as they made the journey. It was about a 40-kilometer journey from Capernaum on the north shore of the Sea of Galilee down to a town called Nain. Nain was about 6 or 7 kilometers from Nazareth, the place where Jesus grew up as a little boy. Perhaps Jesus had visited Nain as a young boy. Maybe he'd even spent some time working there with his carpenter father. We don't know. It was close to where he grew up. But Jesus makes this journey, and there's this huge entourage with him, if you will. His 12 disciples, those he'd appointed to be with him as his apostles, they're with him, and a large crowd travels with him. Jesus makes this journey, and Luke tells us that as Jesus and the large crowd with him are traveling, they approach the town gate of Nain. They encounter another crowd, a second crowd. This crowd is coming out of the town. It's a funeral procession. Luke tells us that a woman, a widow, has just lost her only son. Now, obviously, she's a widow. She has already lost her husband. She's buried him in the family tomb, which she is most likely walking to now again. She's walking there this time to bury her only son. We don't know much about this son of hers. Through the language that Luke employs, it seems likely that he is at least a teenager. Luke calls him a young man. We don't know how he died. Was he ill for a long time? Was it a quick illness, or did he die suddenly in an accident? We don't know exactly how long before these events he died, but we can safely conclude that it's within 24 hours. In that culture where it was hot and there was not refrigeration and other forms of preserving a body, bodies began to decompose very quickly. So it was it's the tradition that within 24 hours you would bury someone who had died. And so that process has happened. They have wrapped his body likely in cloths and they are already bringing him to the graveyard. So this woman, this widow from Nain, has lost her son, her only son, within a matter of hours, really, within a day. Tradition tells us that this woman would have been leading the procession. Behind her were those individuals who were carrying the bier, the open coffin in which the body of her only son was being carried. They would have traveled out of the town gate behind her. Behind that, there would have been other friends, neighbors. Perhaps she had extended family members, no more immediate family. She'd lost her husband. This was her only child, her only son. And so others who knew her, who were weeping with her, and the other professional mourners, those who would weep and wail and cry aloud so that those who were mourning and grieving could weep and cry and not worry about making a scene. They would have followed next, and then the rest of the people of Nain would have, out of respect for this woman and the lost one, the dead young man, they would have followed behind. I want us to take a moment. I want us to pause and reflect on that scene. Two crowds converging at the town gate. One large crowd of people, including Jesus' disciples and others who are following Jesus from Capernaum down to Nain, are approaching the town gate, and there's another crowd being led out by a grieving widow coming out of the town to bury her only son. And here at the town gate, they create a huge traffic jam. But this traffic jam is no accident. It has been divinely orchestrated. Something truly, truly marvelous is about to unfold. The power of God is about to be manifested in a remarkable manner. I want you to bear that setting in mind as we walk through the rest of the story. It is at this point in the story that the first of the four things that we see, that we discover, that we're reminded of about Jesus comes into focus for us. What we see here is that Jesus enters into this woman's pain. She enters into this moment of extreme darkness. He enters into her despair. Think about this grieving mother. Women in that culture were among the marginalized. To say that they were limited in their opportunities was a gross understatement. Incredibly dependent on the men in their lives. Before marriage, upon their fathers. After marriage, upon their husbands. And thereafter, upon their sons. But this woman is a widow. She's already buried her husband. Now her son, her last hope, humanly speaking, for economic survival, for protection, for care. He has died and she is about to bury him. This woman is not only filled with unspeakable grief, she finds herself walking into the future incredibly vulnerable. She is leading her son's funeral procession. She's walking into a future that will be filled with despair and destitution. And as we read these couple verses, we feel the darkness. We feel the weight of despair. We feel it. We can taste it. And we are meant to. Because Jesus wants us to see this. He wants us to recognize that it is precisely in this moment that he shows up. That Jesus enters into those moments of darkness. That Jesus enters into those moments of despair. Luke wants us to see that. And when things look bleak, when she is in darkness and desperation, Jesus enters her life. Jesus enters and he interrupts the funeral procession. Can you imagine being there? Can you imagine seeing that? Imagine that, what that would look like if that were to happen today. A whole line of cars, a funeral procession slowly going down the street, and suddenly from the lanes of traffic coming the other way, this big 15-seater van pulls over. Jesus jumps out of the driver's seat, his 12 buddies with him. Stop! Just hijacking this burial procession, this funeral procession. Jesus enters into that darkest of moments. He enters into her life, her world, when she is filled with despair and desperation. We live in a world that is marked by death. Because of sin, this world is not the way it's supposed to be. Because of sin, death has entered the world. Because of sin, each one of us will face death unless Christ comes first. We live in a world where things are not the way they're supposed to be. We live in a world marked by death, surrounded by death. Just yesterday, walking out of my office, encountered someone, an acquaintance, who asked me to pray for her. In the last week, she's lost her father-in-law and a dear mentor. About 6 weeks ago, a four-year-old boy, block and a half from our house, was hit by a car and killed as a grieving mom. Just 2 months ago, we lost a member of our own church family. We're surrounded by death. And it's important that we not limit our understanding of death to merely to the act of dying. Death has imprinted so much of what's going on in our broken world. As we observe violence, as we see or experience poverty and hatred and sickness, we see the tentacles of death lurking. We live here in North America. We live in, I think, the most death-denying culture this world has ever seen. But the truth remains that we live our lives surrounded by death. Every one of us, if you live long enough, you will walk through dark times. You will experience despair. You will experience distress and despondency. What Luke's story reveals, what Luke's story points us to, what Luke's story reminds us of, is that when those days come, and they will, Jesus is with us. Jesus enters into those moments. We will never walk alone as his children, as those who put our faith in him. Jesus is with us. Jesus is present in the darkness. Jesus meets us. He enters into those moments of despair. The author of Hebrews says, God has said, never will I leave you. Never will I forsake you. That's a promise. It's a promise from the one who is always faithful, who always speaks the truth. Jesus enters into and meets this woman in her darkest moment of despair. The second wonderful, amazing thing that we discover in this text about Jesus really follows on the heels of that one. Not only does Jesus enter into those experiences of darkness and despair, but he enters into them with a heart full of compassion. Look at verse 13. When the Lord saw her, that's this mother, his heart went out to her and he said, "Don't cry." Compassion characterizes the person of Jesus. Compassion characterizes the heart of God. Compassion characterizes the ministry of Christ on earth. He cares deeply for people. He cares deeply for those whom he has created. He cares deeply. The word translated compassion speaks to a deep emotion, emotion in your inner being, in your guts. Jesus' heart went out to this woman, this widow, this grieving mother. We see the place of compassion if we read through the scripture. We see that compassion really is a key central characteristic of who God is. In Psalm 145, we read these words, "The Lord is gracious and compassionate, slow to anger and rich in love." The Lord is compassionate. Jesus tells a story in a few chapters in Luke, story of the prodigal son, and well, the son who ran away and wasted his wealth in a life of sin. He's on his way back just to beg to be a servant, a slave, so that he can eat something. And it says the father saw him while he was a far way off, and his heart was filled with compassion. God is a God of compassion. Jesus' heart was filled with compassion, and it's filled with compassion today. When he enters into those dark moments of despair in our lives, he does so with a heart full of compassion for you, for me. Compassion is who he is. He is the compassionate one. And as those who are created, as women and men who are created to reflect his likeness, to reflect his character, as his image bearers, as he restores us, he calls us to be women and men who would likewise demonstrate compassion in the story of the Good Samaritan. Jesus holds up this Samaritan, this hated foreigner, as an example to those who would follow him. He says the Samaritan looked on the man who was beaten, and he was moved by compassion. We are called to reflect that compassion of God in our relationships with one another, in our interactions with one another. God enters into our despair. He enters into those dark moments with us, with a heart filled with compassion, with love. Do you believe that? Do you know that? Do you trust that? That whether the pain that you experience has been dropped into your life by forces beyond you, or whether the pain that you are walking through is self-inflicted result of your sin and foolish rebellion, God is the compassionate one. God is not surprised when we fail. Our sin doesn't shock him. He loves us. He wants us to be holy, to flee sin. He wants us to obey, not because he's a killjoy, but because he knows that sin destroys us, that sin ruins our lives. And so he is for our greatest joy. And so when we sin, when we rebel, even then his heart is filled with compassion for us. So do you know, do you believe that in your darkest moments, that in those times of despair, when you walk through the deep valley, do you believe, do you know that God's heart is filled with compassion for you? At this point in the story, we come to the third discovery, the third remarkable, wonderful thing that we see about Jesus and his ministry. Verse 13 again, when the Lord saw her, his heart went out to her and he said, "Don't cry." Now, I know we're supposed to follow the example of Jesus, but I'd suggest we don't say this to someone at a funeral. Don't cry. Are you serious, Jesus? This is a grieving widow about to bury her only son. Don't cry. Yeah, try that. But Jesus is not you. He's not me. Jesus knows something. He knows what he is about to do. He knows that the power of God, that he is going to demonstrate that power and do something remarkable which will change everything. And so which changes even these words that on the surface seem callous. Don't cry. And then we read this in verses 14 and 15. Then he went up and touched the bier they were carrying him on, and the bearers stood still. He said, "Young man, I say to you, get up." The dead man sat up and began to talk, and Jesus gave him back to his mother. These moments would have been shocking for everyone there for a number of reasons. First, Jesus says these words that seem so callous and unkind, "Don't cry." But second, because Jesus walks up to the bier on which the dead man is being carried and he touches it. That was something you weren't to do. You weren't to come in contact with the dead. It made you unclean. And so here Jesus does something that culturally was verboten. You just didn't do this. But Jesus does. He walks up into that procession and he touches the bier with this dead man's body on it. And notice those carrying it stopped immediately. They're shocked. I mean, this sort of thing, it just didn't happen. You didn't do it. What Jesus did was completely unexpected. In Numbers 19:11, we read, "Whoever touches a human corpse will be unclean for 7 days." Jesus did the unthinkable in that culture. What we need to understand is that as Jesus reaches out, he touches this and becomes ritually, ceremonially unclean. I don't know if it rings any bells for you, but there was a story earlier on in Luke where Jesus reached out. Do you remember the leper? Jesus reached out and touched a man covered with leprosy. That would have made him unclean, but what did we see in that story? The flow was reversed, right? His cleanness went to the leper. The leper was healed. And pointing to the fact that Jesus takes on our uncleanness and he makes us clean. Here, he takes on death. And he's about to make this young man alive. See, something bigger is happening here. Yes, Jesus raises this young man back to life. But this young man will die again one day. This miracle, this amazing deed points to a greater reality that Jesus has come to overcome death. And he's come to do it by taking death into himself, that one day, not too far in the future, Jesus himself will lay down his life and be nailed to a cross, and he will suffer the death that you and I deserve. He will bear the consequences of our sin, so that through faith in him, we will be made alive, we will be made righteous, we will be set free and made holy. Paul writes in 2 Corinthians 5:21, God made him who had no sin to be sin for us, so that we might become the righteousness of God. Jesus reaches out and takes on death. He takes it on himself, and he speaks these words to this corpse. Arise. Get up. Young man, I say to you, get up. And then Luke says, the dead man sat up and began to talk. And Jesus gave him back to his mother. Have you ever stopped and wondered, what did the young man say? He sits up and begins to talk. What's going on here? Why all the long faces? Mom, who's the guy with the beard? What's he say? Sits up in the middle of his own funeral procession and begins to talk, and Jesus gives him back to his mother. There's a fourth thing that we discover, that we recognize as we walk through this story, looking for the lessons it teaches us about Jesus. We see that Jesus enters into our experiences of darkness and despair and grief, and he leads us from that place to a place of worship. Look at me at verse 16. They were all filled with awe. They were all filled with awe and praised God. They are amazed. No kidding. They are amazed. They are filled with wonder. They're filled with awe. And they praise God. They worship him. When we experience the ministry of Jesus, when we see Jesus, when we understand his compassion for us, when we experience his presence in the midst of our darkest moments, as we experience and see that he took on death for us to give us life, when we see that, we cannot help but be moved to awe and worship. We're moved to worship. We're filled with awe. The God of the universe loves us. The God of the universe is present with us. The God of the universe's heart is filled with compassion for me. The God of the universe is present with me. God of the universe gives me life through his own death. Now, it's worth noting that the people here fail to grasp who Jesus really, truly is. What's their immediate response, their understanding? Well, there's bells going off in their head, right? Because this kind of thing has happened before. Back when Elijah was around, he raised a widow's son to life. 1 Kings, we can read about it. And Elisha, in 2 Kings, he too raises a boy back to life, the Shunammite's son. And so they conclude what seems reasonable. A great prophet has appeared among us. If you were here last week, you'll recall that we recognized that the faith of the centurion was not a fully formed faith. He didn't understand that Jesus was God. He knew that somehow Jesus had a connection with the power of God. Remember his illustration, I'm a man under authority. He thought Jesus had some unique thing going on with God. He didn't recognize that Jesus himself was God in the flesh. His faith was not fully formed. It wasn't about the perfection of his faith. It was about the direction of his faith, the object of his faith. This morning, we recognize that these people, their understanding of who Jesus is not yet complete. They're moving in the right direction. God, and they rightly conclude when they say, God has come to help his people. In fact, that's more true than they even begin to grasp. God has come to help his people. He has. He has, not just as a great prophet, God in the flesh, Yahweh, in the human body. As we come in for a landing, I want to remind you of what I said earlier, that there is more going on here than simply the particular events of this story. This story is revelatory. Jesus miracle is revelatory. It tells us about who he is. It tells us about what he is like. It tells us about what he's all about. And in this story, we watch as Jesus confronts and conquers death, physical death. It goes without saying that physical death is awful, it's horrible. But something that I want us to recognize is that there is a death that is worse, and that is, of course, spiritual death. Life apart from Christ, life apart from faith in Christ, life apart from the one who made you and loves you. You see, if we walk away from this story this morning simply with warm and fuzzy feelings because, wow, Jesus has this power and that's pretty amazing, it's a cool story, but we fail to understand that the gift of life that he offers is greater than physical life. We fail to grasp that. If we fail to receive that gift through faith, then I have failed to adequately unpack this passage this morning. Because this is about far more than just physical life. This young man would one day die again. Just as every one of us will one day face our death unless Christ comes first. We live in a world where we are surrounded by death. No, there is something that is far worse than even physical death, and that is spiritual death. That is life apart from Christ. And so this morning, as we see Jesus, as we encounter the one who enters into our despair and dark valleys, the one who enters into those places of our lives with a heart filled with compassion, the one who confronts and conquers death, both physical death but also spiritual death, the one who leads us into a life of worship, we have to ask the question, this question. There were, in this story, there were two crowds. There was one crowd that was walking out of the town, walking behind this widow to the grave, without hope. And there's another crowd that was walking behind the author of life, the one who saves, the one who forgives, the one who is full of love. And my question is, which crowd are you in? Are you leaning on Jesus? Have you come to Jesus and said, Jesus, you are my only hope? Not a happy life free of pain. You, Jesus, you are my hope because I know that dark days will come. And when they do, I will weep. I will grieve. I'll be torn apart, but I will know your presence in the midst of those days. I will know a hope that comes in the fact that you love me and are with me and carry me. And I will be filled with hope because I know that you are the one who has confronted and conquered death, that death does not get the last word. And I will be moved to worship and adore and glory in your goodness, glory in your beauty. Or have you yet to do that? Do you find yourself this morning walking in that other crowd, walking towards the grave without that hope? Maybe you don't feel it. Maybe everything in life seems like it's pretty good, but I promise you, live long enough and you will suffer. Live long enough and you will die. I mean, that day is coming. We face this reality. I don't say that as a threat. It's just reality. It's the reality of our life. It's the reality of our world. And Jesus holds out hope. He holds out his love and his grace to all. He says, come. We don't need all of our questions answered. We need to come. We need to say, Jesus, I don't claim to understand all of this, but I know I need you. My heart is drawn to you. I want to change crowds. I don't want to be in the crowd that's just walking to the grave without hope. I want to follow you, the author of life. So if that's you this morning, I urge you in the quietness of your heart, just cry out to Jesus. Say, Jesus, I want to be yours. I want to lean on you. I trust you. I want to follow after you, the author of life. people say, God has come to help his people. God has come to help his people. In the midst of a world filled with darkness and pain and death, the author of life has come. The author of life who loves us. The author of life who is present with us. The author of life who gave his life, who died in our place to give us life, to give us hope, to fill us with joy, even in the midst of great pain and tears. My prayer, my hope, is that every one of us this morning would be reminded again of the beauty, the glory, of the wonder of Christ, and that we would be drawn to him, that we would worship him, that we would be filled with joy that is found only in him, because he has come to help his people, a greater help than we can imagine, a greater help than we can put into words. He has come to rescue us, to save us. Amen.